Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you here on bbsradio.com for the next hour. And before bringing our guest on, just want to remind you, it is March the 15th on the East Coast, and still March the 14th on the West Coast. And we've got all kinds of crazy stuff happening in the world of finance, the world of banking, and the world of the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury. And all of this is really related to some of the stuff we're going to talk about tonight, because the finances of this country are upside down, but they never seem to run out of money to spend on secret projects, especially when it comes to outer space. And I submit to you that it has everything to do with the world's problems, and particularly those in the United States. And I guess with that, I will introduce tonight's guest. He is a regular on Evident Footprints every week, in fact, and we have been reserving Fridays for him so that he can sleep in Saturday morning. And he is a well-known scientist, author, lecturer, inventor, and teacher, and his name is Jim Murray, and we welcome him to Evident Footprints. Jim, good evening.
Good evening, Don. I hope you feel as good as I do. This has been a great week.
Do you feel good today?
Yeah, actually, health-wise and otherwise, I feel pretty good.
Well, that's great. And despite everything going on, we're still able to keep a chipper attitude, aren't we?
Well, you know, it's the Irish in me, I guess. We just keep plodding along, and accept what comes when it comes. You know, there's no point in being glum.
Mm-hmm. That's true. This week, Jim, I don't know if you got to listen to any of my shows, but we had a pretty spiritual week. We talked about a lot of crazy things going on in the world and where things are headed, and there was a lot of spiritual talk. Earlier in the week, I had two nights, in fact, I had Win Free on. He has a show on BBS Radio, and he has been in touch with the Council of the Elohim. And what is really exciting about the message he has is it transcends all the religions and the essence of what a religion should be. It talks about the changes to the earth, changes in the solar system, changes in what we would call the multidimensional time frame, if you want to call it that. And we had an interesting discourse about a lot of the things you and I talk about. The message isn't necessarily religious. It's more spiritual in nature, but it's not devoid of science. It's not devoid of reality. In fact, it addresses the information coming out to Wynn has been focused on seeing things the way they really are, not the way they're presented to us. And that's been the focus of what you and I talk about. We talk about a lot of challenging topics, energy, the anomalies of space, and lately we've been talking about planets, in particular Mars, based upon some of the information that's been released. Actually, some of the pictures that you and I have been talking about have been out anywhere from 6 to 7 years, believe it or not. But the photos have slowly made their way, let's say, to the public domain on the internet. And some of those photos that you and I have been talking about are courtesy of a female that works for the European Space Agency. And I guess they share some of these photos with NASA. Some are from NASA, but not necessarily released to the public by NASA. So we're rather fortunate to be able to look at these pictures, which corroborate not only what Richard Hoagland talks about quite a bit, but even what you have been saying, and to a lesser extent what I've been saying. I'm basically out of thin air just been saying, I know we've been on Mars, I know there's life up there, and it's coming to the forefront. The images speak thousands of words, as you well know. I presume you may have had a chance to look at more photos, but I know we also didn't cover what you wanted to cover last week.
Well, it's not that we didn't cover it. You know, there was no hurry in my schedule, and quite frankly, you know, when we embarked on some of the discussions that we had, they led into tangential areas, but they were equally exciting, so there was no reason really to be concerned about the fact that we didn't stay on track.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to stay on track this evening, it's easy enough to do. What we had been doing, for the sake of people listening who may not have been with us last week, we had made a list of various science fiction movies that I found particularly interesting as a kid. And in reviewing them in recent times, it was noted that the themes of some of these things are suddenly very realistic and even prophetic in some aspects. And so what we had been doing was basically talking about the original plot and then trying to find its counterpart in the real world. And, of course, that led to a multiplicity of other conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why I think we spread out, Don. It wasn't because there was any concern about staying on track.
Yeah.
But
To add to what you just said, we did go off on a tangent about the pyramids in Egypt, and that's a topic that came up numerous times this past week on other shows too. So there's a synchronicity happening there. So I think we're still hitting the mark, even though we may have seemed to have strayed from our original topic. And I think I finished with the Three Stooges go to Mars. So
yes, you added that in, which was of course very touching. But you know, the thing that's interesting, you talk about the pyramids, the entire history of Atlantis and the fact that it appears from the writings of many individuals that Egypt, as well as other places, were literally colonies of Atlantis where the survivors went and started a new life after they lost their mother continent. And this information has been floating around for quite some time. In recent years, there's been a great deal of additional scientific information to support some of the material that had been originally given to us by people like Edgar Cayce and some of the other psychics and prophets and Rosicrucians and heaven knows who else. But the reason I bring this up is because there's this new movie out called 10,000 BC, and it's interesting that this is basically the theme of that movie. There's the original construction of the pyramids 10,000 years ago, and the fact that it was overseen by survivors from Atlantis and things of that nature. It's really a very interesting movie. I thought it was very well done.
I hadn't seen it. Now, there was a promo in the form of a trailer, and I think I saw something like a caveman, or, I mean, do they approach it like they were cavemen at that time, or?
Well, actually, I think some of it has been very well researched in terms of the details. The problem is that they don't take the time to relate all the background information. They almost assume that you know what's going on. But, you know, in that time period, right after the ending of the last ice age, there were people in various parts of Europe and Asia that were living by literally tracking and hunting mammoths. And then they literally had homes that were built out of mammoth skeletons, and these were covered with hides. And they made an interesting little hut. That's stuff that has surfaced. I'm not too keen on it because I don't have the time to get into it in great detail, but that surfaced, you know, I'd say within the last 10 years or so. And then the whole business about the Sphinx being eroded by water erosion and not wind erosion forces the age of that structure back to approximately 10,000 B.C. And there is the pyramids themselves, which, of course, were never tombs, and some of the huge temples in the immediate area, which are built below the level of everything else, which is very interesting because either they were submerged in construction or else they predated the rest of the area filling in over the centuries. That's not really clear. But the point is that there's a lot of information emerging which seems to suggest that, you know, the world of 10,000 BC was extremely different from what has been talked about in the history books. And I was kind of thrilled, to be honest with you, to see that an attempt was made to portray these facts in this movie. And to get back to the question you asked, they weren't depicted as brute, stupid cave people. You know, they were essentially Cro-Magnon men that had you know, their own concerns and their own interests and what have you. You know, some of them were taken as slaves, and the others decided to do something about it. I don't want to give away the whole story, but that's essentially, you know, the subplot to the whole thing. But it's a very interesting movie and very well done, and I enjoyed it. And, of course, anybody that's in the know as to what's really going on in these, in light of these modern discoveries and theories about the development of our planet since the last ice age will be particularly interested to see that these facts have been embedded in the storyline. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Well, I'll have to make it a point to try to see it. I can't remember the last time I was in a movie theater, but if you say it's worth seeing, I'll have to take you up on that, I guess.
Well, I thought it was very good, and the special effects are incredible. I don't know how the heck they did the mammoth, but they got the details really, really down pat. Even to the texture of the hairs and the color of the fur and all this kind of stuff. Of course, uh-huh. they might have been elephants wearing body wigs, but I don't think so.
Oh my goodness! Okay. Well, anyway, we're letting the audience know what we talked about last week in case they missed the show. So, is there anything else that you wanted to cover since we went on that tangent a second time?
We had been addressing the various movies and then discussing their plots and how they pertain to the modern scene. And if you want, I still got quite a few left here that we didn't touch on. We can bounce back to that. I'm sure we'll digress again because it seems to be the thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next one
we had left off with the absent-minded professor, and that brought us into a discussion of weather control and the work of Wilhelm Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And you had taken it from there, and I don't remember exactly where it went after that. But the next movie that I had seen as a youngster, which I thought was really fantastic because it was so very different, was called The Magnetic Monster. And it was actually a fascinating movie because it was about a discovery of a new isotope, which had the unusual characteristic of growing instead of disintegrating. And once the activity had been started, this thing just began to absorb energy from its surroundings and continue to grow and threaten to become so large that it would eventually knock the Earth out of its orbit or something.
Sounds like I was going to say, it sounds like the federal government you're talking about there.
Well, there you go. There's a parallel already.
Okay,
but
go ahead.
The reason I chose this as a point of discussion is for two reasons. First of all, the interesting thing is we've all heard Albert Einstein's wonderful formula E equals mc squared, which of course is the mass energy equivalency formula, and essentially it talks about the release of nuclear energy from the mass of certain atoms. And most people don't realize that the reverse is also possible, at least in theory. And that is that energy can be made to coalesce and become solid material. And the reason I found that this is so interesting, of course, was because we had discussed in earlier shows about particle accelerators and the vortex theory and all of this stuff, and that lends itself directly to a mechanism that the Supreme Being may have used in the creation of solar systems and planets and stars and things of that nature, where these vortexian forces, otherwise known as black holes, draw in material, energy, light, whatever is in their vicinity, and compact it into a central location until after X number of years, lo and behold, you have a planet, you have a moon, you have a star, depending on the size of the vortex, whatever it builds. And this type of idea, the mechanism behind creation, is something which is popping up a lot lately. I don't know if you've heard about this Indian fellow. You'll forgive me because I don't remember his name. But he's rocked the boat quite considerably with his theories of creation now and rediscovering the geometry of the universe. And it's all along these lines. The thing that's interesting is that his forefathers talked about these very things and published similar information in Sanskrit writings that go back at least 10,000 years. And the first time they were translated, nobody knew what to make of them because the technologies they were describing were in advance of the knowledge that was available at the time, and the people who were translating it couldn't figure out what they were translating. And nowadays, of course, it all makes sense, and it's been retranslated, and this guy has a couple of DVDs available where he discussed this stuff, and it really, really is exciting. So I thought it was perhaps a vanguard of what's on the horizon and worth talking about, considering the fact that it was the basis of a 1953, I think, or 54 sci-fi movie. I thought that was pretty interesting.
I don't know if I recall that movie. Who was the main actor, or let's say the star, in that? Do you remember?
Yes and no. I know he's a guy with... his name begins with a C. I can't remember exactly what it is. It's Carlton or something like that. And he's in all of Class B sci-fi movies from that era. And if you ever saw his face, you'd know him immediately.
I can almost see it now, yeah. He plays but anyway, role as a professor or something like that usually.
Yeah, usually a scientist or a professor or else some guy that's just a little smarter than the fellow next door. But anyway, it's a very interesting movie. As a matter of fact, I got so excited about it after I got thinking about it. I hadn't seen it since I was very young. And I actually tracked it down and ordered a copy of it. So,
oh, wow.
I'll let you know if I still like it after I see it. What happens a lot of times, Don, is I'll have these fantastic memories of movies that I enjoyed as a kid. And there's a certain amount of emotional content associated with it that's still alive in me. And then I'll finally find a copy of the movie and I'll look at it and I'll say, oh my God, it's awful.
Well, it's funny, these, and I don't mean to digress, but there's a character that they portray. These guys are professors or they're scientists, and they have their long sleeve shirt, white, let's say like a white long sleeve shirt with the sleeves rolled up once or twice, and a sweater vest, and occasionally they'll have a pipe, and they have that Brill Cream look about them. And then they fall in love with the lab assistant, who inevitably gets into a bathing suit at some point in the movie, you know, before the monster comes. It's a recurring
thing. That sounds exactly like the plot from Creature of the Black Lagoon.
Oh, yes.
It's exactly. As a matter of fact, the same guy we're talking about played in that movie also.
Yes, I know the guy you mean then. Yeah. Don't remember his name, but I know the character. Yeah. Or Michael Rennie in the Day the Earth Stood Still, you know.
That was an absolute classic. And, you know, the only reason I didn't put that on the list is because it hasn't happened yet. But I think it's going to.
Okay. Well, didn't mean to interrupt you. It was just that imagery coming out, you know. I had to get my 2 cents in.
Well, Don, there's no problem. It's your show, and I enjoy the things you bring up. So, I mean, don't feel badly about it.
Well, thanks for that vote of confidence there.
No problem. Now, I'm sorry. Did you want to say something else?
So I was just going to have you repeat the title. That was The Magnetic Monster?
Yeah, because the isotope used to put out this very powerful magnetic field and draw things into it. And as a matter of fact, that's how the movie starts. It actually starts in a laundromat. And it's really funny, but because some old woman is trying to get her wash done, and all these weird things are happening, and all these magnetic effects are going on in the laundromat. And it turns out that the scientist who had discovered this stuff had a sample of it in his apartment, and he lived above the laundromat. And that's how the thing gets started. Anyway, it's a good movie.
Big budget, I can tell.
Well, we won't discuss the budget, but the intention was there.
Yes, I understand.
Now, the next one that I think is very interesting, and I'll also bring about the fact that it touches on my own work considerably, and I never, ever forgot this movie. I was so excited about this movie when I was a kid that even now when I look back at it, I have a little bit of trouble understanding why it turned me on so much. But still, the emotional content is quite alive. It's called Night Key. And believe it or not, it's the star of the show is our dear friend Boris Karloff. And he doesn't play a monster or a freak of any kind or a grave digger or any of the roles that you think he should be found in. Instead, he's this very humble electrical engineer who has perfected a completely new type of alarm system. And the alarm device that he has functions in a very novel way. He has an electronic contraption that allows him to influence various electrical effects at a distance. And of course, you know, the whole idea of doing things at a distance back in the 1920s and 30s was still considered to be pretty miraculous. Nowadays, mm-hmm. you got radio control and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But he was doing this very early on, and it's a very interesting movie. But anyway, the reason I used it as a parallel was because, as you know, my interests have always gravitated toward the work of Nikola Tesla. And Tesla had perfected ways of controlling electrical circuits at a distance, which, to my knowledge, have not yet been rediscovered. And, of course, he was doing this with etheric forces, which our technology today does not believe in and does not accept. And so, naturally, they pawn it off as a fable. But the parallels are very, very close. And the idea, of course, is the ability to control energy devices at a distance. And not just from the point of view of electronic control like you use on changing your TV channel or running a model airplane, but heavy-duty devices. And we all know that Tesla was experimenting with the ability to transmit pure electrical power across the planet with no wires, which is a feat that is absolutely astounding in itself. And today there are offshoots of Tesla's technology which are being used for some rather sinister purposes to control the weather at a distance and to project messages into the sky so that the public will be awestruck and influenced by these things when they come to pass. And this all seemed to me to be a very updated version of the same concept, and that's the reason why I thought I'd mention it, though.
Now, are you referring to HARP, or are you referring to holograms, or...?
Well, either or. HARP, of course, is... been described by so many people to do so many things that it's difficult to know how reliable the information is at this stage of the game. But assuming that one-tenth of it is true, it could be quite an interesting piece of machinery when it's put into action. And it may already have been used to control weather and to do other things. And as far as holograms are concerned, I think that they've probably progressed, you know, to an enormous extent beyond what we're allowed to know.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that seems to flow from the same basic idea. It's really amazing to me that the sci-fi writers appear to be like prophets. You know, they get the inspiration before anybody else does, and they turn it into words because that's what they do. And then sometime after that, then the technologists come along and say, well, heck, we can actually do this. And before you know it, something actually appears in the real world.
Do you ever wonder if it's maybe the other way around and that they leak the information to the science fiction writers to put into the scripts so that they can sort of leak this stuff out and kind of prepare us maybe 10 or 20 or 30 years ahead for what they already know?
Oh, sure. That could be possible, too. But I base some of it on the fact that I have received some really interesting inspirations myself. And I know that, at least in my personal case, the way the information progressed is that, you know, you receive it as this explosion of information in your mind, which happens in a millisecond, and it may take you years to understand and process everything that was given to you in that instant.
Mm-hmm.
So then, once you've got it to the point where you figure it out, it would be easy enough to write it down if you wanted to turn it into a story, let's say. But to produce the technology from it takes considerably longer because you have to figure out what it means. You have to associate the concepts with mathematics and physics. Then you have to find some money. Then you have to build prototypes, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it more from the point of view of my own experiences, Don, and that's the reason I shaded it that way. But there's no reason why it couldn't also be used in the manner you suggested,
mm-hmm.
where the technology already exists from whatever source, and they are essentially cueing us to become ready for it.
Yeah.
But why would they bother to cue us, though? That would be my only question.
Well, I think sometimes it has to do with some of the technologies that they plan to put out onto the consumer market. In other words, they figured a way to sell more oil with the transistors. And, you know, really, if you go back to, like, 1963, 1964, with the advent of the miniaturized television, or let's say the reduced size TVs, the 13-inch screen of the Sony Trinitron, really what was going on there is they were selling tons of transistors, which had their basis in petroleum. And that was the beginning of plastics, and it was the beginning of this mass marketing of all of these duplicated parts. And they saw, wow, this is going to be a big market. Well, it wasn't that those technologies were just invented then. I'm sure they had those before World War II. It was now time to start bringing them out and conditioning the public, keeping in mind that the overall technology, especially as applied by the military, was years ahead of anything we've ever been shown. And it's still the same way today.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, our imagination is led to believe that they're traveling around space in these movies, when in reality, they're not just traveling around, they're there. They're on these planets. And they're really fighting battles up there. You know, I tend to be a bit more skeptical about their reasons, because they lie about everything. Why should they be telling the truth? And I think they try to prepare us for these big advances in the movies, aside from the mind control that's there. You know, Flash Gordon, do you remember that series that used to appear like every Friday night or Saturday morning?
I absolutely loved Flash Gordon. My hero was not Flash so much, although I did like Buster Crabbe. But I liked Dr. Zarkov. I thought he was the coolest dude, and he was always doing something with high voltage or, you know, vacuum tubes or something. And, of course, I had a cellar full of the same stuff, so I was just absolutely drawn to the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what the girl's name was, the love interest of Flash Gordon, but I had a crush on her for years. So I definitely watched the movies. I thought they were great.
Well, you know, the special effects were rather primitive in that movie. I mean, I can remember the pyrotechnics shooting out of the tail of the rocket that he flew. But there was, what's interesting is the uniform didn't change so much over the years. The uniform that he wore, the tight-fitting outfit, and the ones that they used in Star Wars or any of the other space movies. In fact, it's those that have a little bit of knowledge about what's going on describe the uniforms that the Galactic Federation is wearing is the same as what you see in the Star Trek movies.
I wouldn't be surprised because you know, there's a certain functional aspect to those things that's going to force the design, you know, to take certain shapes. And that's not a surprise to me. I would like to see, frankly, somebody like Vice President Cheney wear the robes of Ming the Merciless.
Maybe he does.
I think that would be really interesting. Sorry, that's my digression this week.
Well, could you see Bill Clinton in one of those?
No, not really. He's, I don't know. He doesn't come across with the same vicious character as Ming the Merciless, although he may be. You know,
I did not have sex with that alien. Oh, okay. So, next movie. Are you finished with the one you were on there?
I am, if you are. Yeah, the next one that I thought was really pretty interesting is The Time Machine. And we had talked about that on another show one time. But the reason why I think this is so interesting is because, of course, in the original plot by H.G. Wells, the inventor figures out a way to build a machine that can move in the fourth dimension. And he decides to go into the future and to see what's going to happen to the planet and if he can, in fact, be of any usefulness in the future eras. And one of the things that he finds when he gets to this destination, which I forget it was like 200,000 years in the future, so it's hard for me to remember the date. But anyway, when he gets there, he finds that the human race has essentially split into two factions. There are the technological types that live underground and control everything, and they were called the Morlocks. And then there's the Eloi, who are the fun-loving, what you would call humanoid type, that remain above ground and are essentially bred by the Morlocks. And you find out at one point, of course, that they are devouring them for food. Well, the parallel that struck me is that it seems to me that the human race is, in fact, splitting into two factions. I don't know where this is going. Of course, they're not becoming things like the Morlocks necessarily, but what I've noticed is that you have people that are so complacent and so detached from what's happening in the world around us that it's almost disturbing. It is to me anyway. And then
Weren't the Eloi sort of like zombies in a way? I mean, they were hippies. They were like the first hippies.
Yeah, that's a very good description of them. I mean, they spent all day sunbathing and making love and eating fruit and dancing. And I'm sure that they probably were watching baseball games on TV and drinking beer also. But that's exactly my point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got this strange split in the world. You've got this controlling faction that doesn't want to be seen, so in a sense they're underground, and they're exerting this control through the money system, through huge corporations, and the military in various ways. And then you've got the light-hearted, dim-witted Eloi that are essentially, you know, just bouncing along without any cares, not too concerned about what's coming next. And that, to me, seems to be something that's a major point of concern.
Yeah, and I can remember the siren going off, and they all sort of went into this little dome-type structure that had an opening down into the earth, in other words, and they sort of just in a trance, kind of marched in single file, gradually to their death until the door closed. And isn't it interesting that the love that our hero, I think that was Rod Taylor, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was.
Was a blonde. She had blonde hair. So
yeah, it was Yvette Mignot.
Oh, whatever, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And very, very
you had
pretty
a crush
young
on
lady.
Her, too, right?
No, actually, I never was. My passion was always for brunettes.
Oh, okay.
But she was pretty, though. No question about it.
Yeah, that's right. That was Yvette. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, you're right. That's exactly what you see when you talk about what's going on in the world today to the average American citizen. You feel like you're in that movie. And it's like...
Well, yeah, and you can take the parallel even further, too, because we don't know what those underground tunnels are being built for, and the day may come when the Eloi are herded in there for the sake of feasting.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be a very pleasant outcome when this begins to happen. We don't know what's really going on.
Well,
but I think the parallels are very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. The warlocks could have been a code word for the reptilians, too, you know. I mean, that's quite possible.
Well, there you go. That spells it out about as clearly as you can make it.
Yeah.
So and there again, we have a...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to add, there's a gray area there, though. So.
A gray area. Okay. But anyway, I was going to conclude by saying, so, you know, there's another example of something that, and that was written, what, about 1914 maybe, something like that. It was just around the time of the Great War. And so in that respect, H.G. Wells was very prophetic. I don't know what signs he was looking at or if he was just hypothesizing about the decline of humanity in general, but boy, he hit a lot of things right on the head, and it makes me wonder where we're headed.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of more modern, let's say, like architecture, or at least the concept of furniture design. I remember they sat on, they weren't necessarily stone benches. They looked like concrete benches and concrete tables to me, if I remember correctly. And I recall the library having been really dilapidated. You know, the books were literally crumbling from neglect more than anything else.
Yeah.
And that's another analogy. I mean, it's symbolic of our lack of education and knowledge.
Absolutely.
And that's definitely prophetic, or it was going on back then, and it's just a generational issue. In other words, as each generation's growing up, if the intent was to dumb everybody down, it was going on all along. You know, it's not a new phenomenon, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, it could actually have... We don't know when all this started, you know, but these tactics have been used against humanity as a whole for a very long time. I remember reading not that long ago about the fact that the present... Maritime legal system, which is really the law that's in use in the court systems, and the tax structure, and the way the government itself is constructed, is pretty much an imitation of what was going on in Rome,
mm-hmm.
you know, 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the cycles keep repeating themselves, and I guess they always will until mankind has enough experience under their belts that they put a stop to it.
Yeah. Now, are there any movies, Jim, out of these, I mean, we're calling these science fiction, but we're really talking about the fact that there are parallels in this reality, if you want to call it a reality. Are there any movies that really show you or that you think are really hinting at what we're really doing, what's really going on?
Well, it depends. You know, I don't think any one movie clearly paints the picture, you know, to the point where it would turn on a lot of people's thinking equipment. But there is one movie that really seems to, in my opinion, bring out a lot of the negativity that has entered the world. And I'm trying to remember the name of it. I can see it in my mind's eye. But anyway, it was a movie that was starring Charlton Heston and, what's the name of that actor who always played the part of gangsters?
Oh, you're going to say Edward G. Robinson.
Yes, thank you. I couldn't catch the name. And it takes place in New York City sometime in the future. And Soylent Green. That's the
Soylent
name.
Green.
Soylent Green. And there's a lot of really terrifying parallels there. And then there's another one called Logan's Run, which is pretty interesting. And the thing that's always stuck in my craw about those two movies, and of course I'm assuming that some of our listeners know the plot, because if I go through the plot of both movies, we'll use up the whole show talking about that. But basically, they're futuristic slave communities, run by unseen forces, in which people are forced to go through all sorts of unsavory gymnastics in response to their master's desires. But the thing that's interesting is most of the control seems to take place in the city proper. And I've always wondered about that. You know, all these discontent people, why the heck didn't they just leave? You know, I mean, I would prefer, if it was me, I would prefer a much sparser life out in the forest or living on the plains or something like that, and scratch around for whatever I could find, but at least I'd be free, or relatively free. And that's something that's really very interesting. I think that there's a remnant of the herd instinct in people, or else it's been deliberately cultivated, that keeps them grouped together in these artificial communities. And as a result of that, they play right into the entire law structure and banking system and control mechanisms that have been designed just for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the irony of it is that theoretically they could walk away. You know, there are places left on Earth where you could hack out an existence and be free of that stuff.
I remember in the end of that movie how Charlton Heston was basically kicking and screaming, it's people or something like that. They're eating people. Soylent Green is people.
That's another issue that we don't know whether or not that's going to raise its ugly head in some form or another.
Actually, I often saw the movie as a parody of the banking system. You know, what color is their money?
Yeah.
You know, the banks are eating everybody up, basically. There's symbology in there, kind of like the Wizard of Oz, you know?
Right.
but what does that kind of movie do? It produces fear, and then people emanate that energy. And that's a recurring theme in the media and in movies. The reason they make those movies is that we give off fear energy. And there are those that feed off of that energy. that's the whole purpose for the scary movies. And I mean, what other purpose, what other good does it serve? It doesn't do anyone any good to become scared. They call it entertainment. Yes.
Well, yeah, and what's interesting about that, Don, is that the threshold that's required to be surpassed in order to introduce or induce, would be a better word, those feelings of fear and the release of adrenaline in the audiences has escalated to the point of almost being unbelievable. I mean, when you consider that people were fainting and had to be carried out of the theaters in 1932 or whatever it was that they released the movie Frankenstein. And actually, Frankenstein is a very benign movie if you really look at it. It doesn't even scratch the surface compared to some of the stuff that's routinely showed now. Mm-hmm. Now you have these horror movies like The Chainsaw Massacre and The Hills Have Eyes and things of that sort. And, you know, they're literally chopping people to pieces and blood flying everywhere and this kind of stuff. And that's the new level that seems to bring about these adrenaline rushes and what have you.
Yeah.
Nobody goes to see the old Dracula and Wolfman movies anymore because they're a joke. But it's almost like we're being pushed towards something.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, it's not wholesome.
Now, I'm inclined to agree with you, and it's really not just in the movies. Mainstream television has turned that way, and the content of what used to be a three-hour show every evening around dinner time until, you know, the kids got their bath or their shower and got dressed in their pajamas to get ready for bed, and Leave It to Beaver came on, it's changed drastically that you have around-the-clock news channels constantly pumping the fear and the propaganda, and what used to be the mainstay of information, the news networks, the three major networks, have reduced their broadcasting to a half an hour filled with drug commercials. The point there is that they've maximized the mind control to the point where they only need a half an hour to get their point across on the major networks. The rest of the programming does all the dumbing down. And again, they bombard you with the drug commercials and they put the fear out there. You're going to get sick, and when you do, you need this medicine. They're inducing all of this psychotic behavior and ill health intentionally to line their pockets and to actually cause people to get sick, because they know the suggestions make them sick. Just like the fear in the movie, you know, produces the adrenaline and gives off that energy, and when the person comes back down to normal, they're more passive. In fact, you know, when you're using your adrenaline just with the power of your imagination or your mind, and you're not actually physically releasing it in a protective mode, it becomes very destructive to the human psyche. That's a form of the mind control. So, you know, there's an aspect and a recurring theme in these movies, even though these are interesting things that allude to more advanced technologies and life in other parts of the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe. They really don't want us to know that. They put it out in the movies almost as if to say, look, movies are fiction. They're not real, and therefore we don't have these public discussions because it's only in the movies that these things happen. It's almost as if that's become a ploy to cover it up, if you understand my meaning.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's a very strange set of circumstances. And the interesting thing is that Hollywood itself is fractionalized because While the main thrust may very well be to follow the agenda you've just described, every once in a while you'll find somebody like Steven Spielberg or this guy, Mike somebody, I can't think of his name, who make a movie of exactly the opposite complexion to try and show people what's really happening. And it makes you wonder how that is allowed. You know,
well, some of it, I think, is disinformation, and some of it is, you know, they mix a little bit of the truth in there to make it palatable. But I, to me, that's how the disinformation apparatus works. It's put enough of the truth out there. Take Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Right.
That mirrors what went on at Edwards Air Force Base or you know, Area 51. I mean, you have these recurring themes there, and some of the actual events in there are described in mainstream ufology as having occurred. Recent release of the Serpo story within the last year and a half, and there was a lot of disinformation in that, but it was supposedly six agents DIA that were coming out, and in other words, the Defense Intelligence Agency had six rogue employees who were secretly letting this information out that we had sent 12 astronauts to a foreign planet. Now, that very well might have happened. But the story is filled with so many contradictions, and it's got holes in it. It's got almost as many holes in it as 9/11. Let's put it that way. They got many of the serious UFO researchers arguing with each other about this, and it kept their attention on this old story that supposedly occurred in the 1960s, and it may have, but. You know, that time is over. That time is up, and it doesn't really matter if we did that. We have pictures now of cities on Mars, and which are much more recent and much more applicable to what's going on today. So there's always going to be this obfuscation of the truth hidden inside all of these obviously orchestrated bits of disinformation that they want us to take in with the truth. And then you can't sort out what's real and what's not real following their method. So that's my rant.
Oh, I think it's a very good point. And, we have to remember that these people, whoever they are, have had unbelievable numbers of opportunities in an untold variety of ways to test their theories of controlling the public, both with modern technologies like TV and radio and in other ways as well. I mean, what could be a more viable and emotionally powered mechanism, for instance, than to stoke the fires of patriotism? I mean, not to say that there's anything wrong with having patriotic feelings for your country, but you know as well as I do that that's been used in many ways to manipulate the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is another good example of that, and I'm sure there are thousands more.
Yes. Well, Jim, we're out of time. I hate to tell you that. That's that phrase that I don't like to use on the show, but we've run out of time. And I want to thank you for all of this wonderful information, especially about the magnetic monster. That one slipped by me somehow. But I look forward to next week. Now, next week, maybe we can kind of gravitate. Unless you've not exhausted your movie collection yet.
No, I'm out of good films, so don't worry.
Okay. Well, we could begin by doing an analysis of the Three Stooges go to Mars, and then we could go back into our discussion about those Mars photos.
Well, actually, what I would like to do, Don, since you've posted so much new stuff, I think I should probably visit your site again and study the new material, and then we can talk about that, because it is not only current in the sense that this is some of the most recent information available to us from these sources, but it's also an amazing subject when you stop and think of it.
Yes.
And I'm very glad that it's coming out. I just wish that we could get a better hook into what's really going on.
Yes. Well, I want to let you know, Jim, along with my listeners, that next week, starting Monday, my special guest will be Alejandro Rojas, who is the MUFON International Director of Public Relations. And we're going to be talking about disclosure and some of these things. So you might find that to be an interesting show. And I've got Bill Ryan and Carrie Cassidy are going to be on next Wednesday. Now, they have interviewed many folks like yourself. In fact, they should interview you as well. I'm gonna push for that. But they talk to a lot of whistleblowers who have been involved with the space program and the mind control programs and all of this high technology that they're keeping secret, underground bases, all of this stuff. So I got an interesting week coming up next week, and not just for you, Jim, but also for our listeners. So I look forward to next week having you on again and continuing this discussion.
Sounds good, Don.
And I'm going to be putting more photos up on my website. If you'd like to see some of these Mars photos, as well as some of the moons of Saturn and our moon and some spaceships visiting the dark side of the moon, you'll find some interesting photographs. I even have a picture which is of an alien source. There's an alien language on the photo, and this is one of the Mars photos. Go to directlightproductions.com and click on the photos page, and you'll see the album there. And I hope to have more of them up this weekend. And Jim, again, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you next week. And also, my listening audience, thank you for tuning in to bbsradio.com. This has been Evident Footprints. I'm the host, Don Nikoloff, and our guest this evening was Jim Murray, and he'll be back next Friday. In the meantime, peace, love, and light. Have a great weekend, and good night.
Synthesized from